Either way, it's what they have, so here they are. From their hiding spot atop a gentle hilltop plateau, Nora leans forward, parting the sharp-bladed thirst grass like a curtain and peering out through a pair of macro binoculars. Using the dial on the side, she scans through the heat signatures, then clicks over to electric and electronic indicators. The binocs highlight a series of danger spots all around the compound. They glow red in the view screen.
I see them,
she tells Jazz. Jazz, who lies unseen in the tall grass, even though she's only a few meters away. The binocs highlight that the compound is ringed by an invisible perimeter fence. A barrier of ghosted lasers, impossible to see, but sure to cut you apart if you marched through them. The ground leading up to the compound, both in and out of the fence, is littered with landmines. Then, located throughout the compound, are turret droids. Each hides in plain sight near vaporators, looking like part of the mechanism. Stealthy buggers, those. Through the grass, Jazz says,
The place is loaded for war. Aram's protecting himself. I get that he's paranoid, given the changes cascading through the galaxy. But this is a whole other level. He's afraid. And he hasn't come out in days.
From behind them, Nora hears Temin working on something. A tink, 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 followed by a buzzing twist from a microspanner. What is he doing back there? Nora's about to ask when the grass swishes and shakes as Syngier crawls up on his belly.
Ow!
He says, flexing his hand and popping the knuckle of his thumb in his mouth.
This grass is slicing me to bits.
He drinks your blood,
Jazz says, easing closer.
Thirst grass sustains itself on the creatures who walk through it. Little sips from little cuts.
He frowns.
Lovely.
I'm here for my hourly update. And my hourly update is, I am bored. Bored out of my skull.
That's always your hourly update,
Nora says.
Because it's true, every hour.
It's my update, too,
Temin says, crawling up next to them.
Seriously, this is awful. I want to burn all this grass. And the thorny bushes. And the flies.
As if to demonstrate, he swats at the back of his hand.
See? Ugh, I should have stayed on Chandrilla.
Can't we just go back to Kai Pompos?
Syngier asks.
We'd make it by nightfall. There's a little drinkery round the back of the town. They have a still where they ferment this root, this Corva root. So we go back, we tip back a few under the Iridiru moons, we reformulate our strategy.
This is a fact-finding mission,
Nora says, feeling like a mom commanding a child to stay put.
We stay here until all the facts are found.
Facts are, Temin says. The guy isn't coming out. He's dug in like a blood bug.
They'd heard rumors that Aram was a big game hunter, and thought maybe that would afford them an opportunity to get close to him. But so far, no go. Nor has he gone out for supplies, or even a breath of fresh air. They've seen neither hide nor hair of the man, just droids.
Here's what we do. We take Mr. Bones.
Bones sits crumpled up behind them, his skeletal body folded tightly with his head bowed and his arms enclosing his knees.
And we let Bones march down there, find the guy, drag him up here onto the plateau, and we question him. Simple.
As simple as chasing birds with a hammer,
Syngier mutters.
Everyone hush,
Jazz says.
Timon, did you build my thing or not?
Yeah.
He fishes around in his pocket and holds up a pair of devices in the palm of his hand. One looks like a round from a slug thrower, but it's been modified. The shell casing crimps around a circuit bulb, and the tip of that bulb has four little prongs, like insect mandibles. The second device is round, no bigger than a button, with a little zigzag antenna sticking out.
It's a bug,
Temin says, sounding impressed with himself.
This planet has enough bugs without us adding more to it,
Syngier grouses.
And before anyone corrects me, yes, I know, it's a listening bug, and not a real bug, and...
Oh, never mind. Good job, Jazz. Now what?
We can't get eyes on, so we need to get ears on. I load this into my rifle, and fire it right at his mans. Then...
She grabs the second device.
This jury-rigged earpiece with which to listen in.
Clever,
Singer says. Still not sure what I'm doing here. Jazz hands him the earpiece.
You're going to do the listening.
Joy.
He makes a face as he takes it and screws it into his ear. The bounty hunter unslings the slug thrower from her back. Nora again grabs the binocs and focuses them at the compound. A herd of animals have come up alongside the invisible perimeter. Long-limbed, long-necked, leathery things, these beasts. They number in the dozens. Some stop to nip at the tufts of keaki bushes, while the others bat at one another with bony protuberances atop their narrow snouts. Nora is pretty sure they're morak. Big things, but herbivores. Though she'd hate to get stomped onto those long legs. Legs that end in claw-tipped feet. Jazz pulls the slug thrower close and uses her thumb to pop open a bipod at the end of the barrel, giving it stability. She tugs the scope tight against her eye. Nora watches her through the grass, the way Jazz draws a deep breath, then slowly exhales it, until no breath remains, and she is still. It's surprisingly close to what Luke taught Leia, isn't it? Shut out the world. Be mindful, but empty. Like a cup to be filled up. Of course, Jazz does this in order to kill people more efficiently. The bounty hunter's finger coils around the trigger. But then, the morak all look up at the same time. A gesture of alarm. Nora reaches out and touches Jazz's shoulder.
Wait. What is it?
Jazz asks.
Something's up.
Singer plucks the earpiece out of his ear, scowling at it.
This thing is fritzing out. It's making this high-pitched whine. That should sound.
Down below, the morak begin to move. All of them at once. A herd movement. They go from walking to galloping, their long, bony legs launching them forward with a swiftness that surprises Nora. The animals are headed toward the hill where the crew is waiting. Closer, closer. The ground begins to vibrate beneath them. It's too steep, surely. They can't. The animals reach the bottom of the hill and begin to scramble up the side of it. The clawed feet make great haste, and now Nora knows what those claws are for. Dust spirals behind them.
They're coming right for us.
We have to move, Nora cries.
Move!
She and the others spring up out of hiding and turn tail, bolting through the grass. The morak crest the hill, bleeding and blowing mucus from their snouts. The ground rumbles as the herd stampedes. The grass slices at Nora's arms, but she can't waste time caring. Everyone moves fast. Everyone except Bones, who sits somewhere under cover and is hopefully resilient enough to suffer the knocks and blows of the morak. She's not even sure where they should go. Run straight, turn to the side. The morak are coming right up behind them. One lopes past Nora in a lumbering gallop, swiping at her with its long neck. The thing is twice her height, and she just barely darts out of its way, even as others come up behind her. Ahead, though she can't see it, the far side of the hill awaits. What then? Run down it? Trying not to fall? Duck and pray the charging morak go over the edge? The bounty hunter runs next to her, and when one morak comes behind her, Jazz jabs at it with the barrel of her slug thrower, and the beast roves drunkenly toward Nora. It clips her, and she staggers. Her legs go out from under her. There's Temin, grabbing her by the belt to keep her from falling. It's just enough to help her get her legs back under her. Nora is about to thank her son. She doesn't get the chance. A sound hits them. A sonic hum. Suddenly, the morak are squawking and turning sharply away. The herd splitting in twain as if by an invisible wedge. Nora thinks,
"Thank the stars for whatever is doing that."
But then something lands in the grass in front of them. The thing rolls a few times like a flung rock.
It beeps 3 times in succession.
Then, an implosive sound! The air lights up around them. A hard pulse of bright light. It concusses the air, too, hitting her like a thunderclap. Nora is suddenly blind and deaf, her ears ringing, her vision washed away in a tide of searing white. She fumbles for the blaster at her side. She whips it out, and it's suddenly rocked out of her hand, clattering away. A shape emerges in front of her as the white light begins to recede. A person shape, Nora thinks.
Aram has us. We thought we were watching him, but he was watching us.
She leans forward, starts to stand.
"Don't move,"
comes a voice, quiet but urgent. Nora asks as her eyes adjust,
"Who is that? Who's there?"
The figure steps forward. She spies 2 blasters held aloft, one in each hand, and one pointed right at her.
"Name's Han Solo, captain of the Millennium Falcon. Who the hell are you?"
Chapter 17. The little cantina here is less a bar and more a ragtag collection of debris and detritus. The crew sits under mesh netting in an alcove formed by old junk, the war-scorched foot of an AT-AT walker, a stack of tire treads looped end over end, crates whose lids are pulled back just enough to reveal the haunted dead eyes of forgotten deactivated droids. They sit, and they watch the man known as Han Solo. When they saw him on that plateau, he was barely recognizable. A scruffy beard made it hard enough, but then he was dressed in a set of ratty rags. Rags, Jazz realized later, that matched the color of the thirst grass. Smart. His hair is longer, too. Shaggier. Unkempt. Here now, Jazz recognizes in him that smuggler's lean. An easy swagger that the man doesn't have to try to manifest. It's just part of who he is. Part of that bona fide Han Solo charm. He's certainly handsome. A boyish rogue. Jazz would, given half an invitation, mount him like a turret. Though here her mind wanders to Jom. That coward, she thinks. She tries to make her fury at the old commando burn hotter than it does. She fails, and misses Jom Burrell regardless. Solo sits back, arm over an empty chair. There's something else there. Something beyond his swagger and his charm. And her shared looks with Sinjir tell her that he sees it too. Solo is on edge. He's wary, but a smuggler is always wary. This is different. Han Solo is angry. And not just at them, she thinks. The Bith bartender shuffles up, his one leg little more than a crudely fashioned metal prosthetic, and pops glasses in front of all of them. Kurva, the stuff Sinjir was talking about. The smell coming off the glasses is enough to fry an astromech circuits. The vapor blurs the air above the liquid. The Bith sets one down in front of Temin, and Jazz watches Nora rescue the glass before the boy can grab it. He pouts in response. When the Bith is gone, Solo regards them.
"Who are you? And what do you want with Golos Aram?"
The crew shares uncomfortable looks. It's Nora who speaks up.
"We're not interested in Aram. We're looking for you."
It takes a moment for that to register on his face. He laughs then, though no mirth dwells in the sound.
"Well, congratulations, lady. You found me. You can collect your prize at the door."
He clears his throat.
"On your way out, if you get my meaning."
"You are our prize,"
Jazz says. His hand is no longer on top of the table. She knows he's going for his blaster. The others don't get it. They don't understand that he'll clear them with his DL-44 before they even think to unsnap their own holsters. Probably a good idea to get ahead of that.
We're not bounty hunters,
Jazz says, holding up both hands, palms out, a sign of acquiescence and surrender. Sinjir wrinkles his brow.
Jazz, you are a bounty hunter.
Shut up, Sinjir.
Han's gaze flits from each to each.
Who sent you?
You know who,
Nora says.
There.
That wariness, that anger, that edge, it softens and dulls, just for a moment. Like a mask sliding away, showing his true face. He says what he surely already knows.
Leia.
Your last transmission ended abruptly. She thinks something happened to you.
It did. I was on my way here and crossed paths with a slave hauler run by the Dodoth Raiders. Without Chewie in the co-pilot seat, I missed that they were coming up on me fast. And they fired on me and took out my comm array. Again.
You could have found a way to contact her.
He hesitates. Nora fills in the blank.
You didn't want her to come after you.
Of course not. I got my things to take care of, and she has her things. And then, when all that shakes out, I'll go back.
You have things to take care of back home, too.
A moment passes between him and Nora with that exchange. She struck a nerve. Jazz wonders if the woman is playing a dangerous game. Solo is angry,
and anger is irrational.
Here is a man backed into a corner, pinned down by his debts. Nora says,
"We'll help you find your Wookiee."
He's not my Wookiee. Nobody owns Chewbacca. You can be sure of that, sister.
And once again, that war plays out across his face. A softness and a sadness give way to fresh anger. Han suddenly takes his glass and pitches it over the small wall of junk. Somewhere in the distance, a faint sound of glass breaking.
I screwed up! And now Chewie is gone.
His guard drops. He breaks down. Solo tells the story.
A little something came across our dash. An opportunity. And no, before you go looking at me like that, not a smuggler's opportunity, but a real one. The kind that matters. Chewie and me, we've been kicking around now for a long time. He's my partner. He's not just some sidekick. He's not a pet. And he's damn sure not my slave.
It's equal between us.
We always split everything. You understand? We split our share of every job. We split our share of the injuries, too. And sometimes we take on each other's burdens. He's a Wookiee, right? Kashyyyk, that's where he comes from. That's his home. But it's not his anymore. I've been there. I've seen what the Empire has done. They ripped down the trees. They put cuffs and collars on all the Wookiees. Some of them they cut open. Others they ship off to work the worst jobs the Empire has on offer. They took his home from him. I can't abide that. I don't have a home anymore besides the Falcon. But him, he does. And he deserves to go home. He has a family too, you know. I saved him. At least that's what he says. A big fuzzy fool. But really, he saved me. I was on a bad path. And Chewie, he put me straight. Saved my shanks more than once, too. He said it was part of some life debt. He has a word for it. But if I try to say it in his tongue, I'll probably strain something. Even if I can't say it, I know what it means. It means that he owes his life to me. But that's a hot cup of bantha spit is what it is. He doesn't owe me. I owe him. I got a debt to Chewie to get him his home back. So when this chance came up, I leapt at it. The rebels, or the Republic, or whatever they want to call themselves, they didn't want any part of it. I made it clear we need to make Kashyyyk a priority. But they waved me off. Not strategically significant, they said. Not yet. Soon. blah, blah. Bureaucracy and strategy and war planning. They made me a general, but I didn't know a thing about any of that. I don't follow what's on some schematic. I follow what's in here, in my gut. My gut always knows the way. Or so I thought. I leapt at the chance, but didn't look first. Imra, the smuggler who presented this little gift-wrapped opportunity, turns out she was on the wrong side of things. The Empire must have had something on her. And she set up this trap for me. Not just for me. For all of us. I called in favors. Brought a bunch of smugglers to a space not far from Warren Station. And worse, I called in a few other Wookiee refugees, too. Ones I knew would want to scrap with the Empire. Ones who would want to go home. We all got in one place. Half a dozen ships of people willing to work for me. And okay, yeah, maybe I promised them a pardon, even though I didn't know if I could make that magic happen. I mean, I'm no Jedi. I can't just wiggle my pinky and make someone dance. But there we all were. I sent Chewie to board a gunship captained by this Wookiee pirate, Karatha. Next thing I know, we're blown. Two Star Destroyers, plus a swarm of Imperial Starfighters. They're all over us, cutting us apart. They shot out Karatha's engines, hobbling her on the spot, with Chewie still on board. Some ships they wiped off the map. Others they nabbed with tractor beam. And I beat Stardust and got the hell out of there. I didn't know what else to do. I thought that my best bet at getting Chewie and the others back would be from inside the cockpit of the Falcon and not stuck in some cell on board a Star Destroyer. But now I know. I was a coward. I should have sucked it up. Found a way out from on board. I didn't share the burden like I was supposed to. And now Chewie's out there shouldering it all on his own. Ever since, I've been tearing up the galaxy looking for him. Every two-bit Imperial officer I could find told me what I wanted to know, or got his teeth knocked out of his head. Finally, I figured out where they took him. They took him back to Kashyyyk. They took him home.
His eyes shine. His lip purses and twitches even as he fidgets and scratches at his beard. It's then that Jazz gets it. Solo is angry, but he's angry with himself. So why Golos Aram? Nora asks. Why are you out here? The smuggler hesitates. He's still not sure if he can trust them, maybe. Jazz gets it. Trust is hard. It feels like falling.
Finally, Solo says,
story goes, Chewie found himself on board a prison transport. A ship bound for a place called Ashmead's Lock. A prison on the far side of Kashyyyk. Don't know much about it except who built it.
Golos Aram, Jazz says.
Right. I've been watching him. Then you bunch come along, damn near mucking everything up. If I hadn't summoned that herd of Morak, you would have fired that tracking bug on his house. But Golos? He's paranoid. Real paranoid. He does routine sweeps. He'd have found that bug before nightfall and sent out tracker droids to hunt you, and by proxy, me, down.
He kicks his chair out and stands up, arms out.
So you found me. Great. Now go away. Tell Leia... Well, tell her what you want. But I can't have her thinking she needs to fix this. I can't have her in danger. Just tell her I'm okay... And I'll be home soon.
When?
Nora asks.
Just tell her I'll be home on time.
With that, Solo pushes past them and heads out of the junk alcove.
Well, Sinjir says, that solves that. Time to celebrate.
He blasts the glass of Korva down his throat
and has a small spasm as it hits him.
He coughs so hard, he has to wipe his watering eyes.
Oh, this stuff is uniformly terrible. It may...
He burps.
It may be poison.
The rest of them sit quietly, unsure what to do. Nora says finally,
I think we need to...
From close by, the sudden sounds of a scuffle arise. The noise is short, a cry of alarm, a hard thwack, and a subsequent thud. They rush out of the alcove. Just around the corner, near the curva still, lies a body. Han Solo's body. Mr. Bones stands astride the smuggler's supine form.
I subdued the target with violence,
the battle droid chirps, his words punctuated by bursts of sharp static.
Mission accomplished. Victory for all.
Chapter 18. Leia hears voices through the door. She leans in and listens, and as she listens, she finds herself growing furious. Akbar.
Alliances across the galaxy are patchwork. Too many systems stand alone and are falling between the widening fissure between our power and the Empire's own influence. We are not growing swiftly enough to match their decline. We are not bridging that gap.
Mon Mothma.
This is why we must concentrate our efforts, helping those worlds that offer a likelier chance of joining the New Republic, in order to have a voice in the Senate.
One of Mon's advisors, Hostis Idge.
Our resource reserves are stretched thin, Chancellor. But there remains one simple way of obtaining new lines of food, fuel, and other vital supplies.
Mon's other chief advisor, Oxy Cray Corbin.
Oh, please, let me guess. A stronger military? Tell us, how will a more robust military help?
Hostis.
If we step up recruitment, we will have more soldiers to secure supply lines once possessed by the Empire. Such resources are out there in the wind, and who knows who will possess them?
More bluster and clamor. It's time to step in. Leia palms the door panel, and the door hisses open. The metal shutters of the meeting room window are closed, though light from the bright Chandrillan day outside bleeds in at the edges like magma. All around them float various holoprojections, datagraphs, system maps, planet maps, schematics. It adds up to a galaxy in chaos. A galaxy whose allegiance is divided. Not divided merely between the two warring sides of the New Republic and the Galactic Empire, but diced up finely into factions. Those factions will fight. They will fall to one another. They will form their own power structures. Warlords will lead them, as will despots, crime bosses, cult leaders. The galaxy will go from suffering the cruelty of the Empire's order to being thrown into the maelstrom of disorder and madness. It will be an ugly time, Leia knows, if the New Republic cannot see its way clear through this labyrinthine tangle. A dark time. As she steps into the room, all eyes fall to her. They are surprised. Surprised even though she has a chair of her own in this room. A chair that presently sits empty between Mon Mothma and Admiral Akbar. The chair sits empty because no one told her of this meeting. She was kept away on purpose.
Leia,
Mon Mothma says, standing up.
Welcome. Sit. I'll stand.
She hears the frostiness in her own voice. Leia thinks to control it, then decides against it.
Let them be frozen out the way they are trying to freeze me out. Having a meeting? Please understand,
Mon says.
You're going through a hard time. With your husband gone, and that unfortunate situation with that crew.
Yes, how unfortunate.
You are, of course, welcome to sit. Join us. Offer your thoughts.
I told her,
Akbar says, his voice a gruff gurgle. Mon nods.
Of course. It was my mistake, Leia, for not inviting you. I simply thought you had a great deal on your mind already.
Leia is more than just the face of our efforts across the galaxy,
the Admiral says, giving a little nod as if to agree with himself.
She is also a precious resource unto herself. Smart and savvy, and a needed voice.
Akbar, Leia realizes, is a good friend. Mon is too. She has to remind herself of that. But Mon is a realist. Sometimes that seems cold. And Leia is an idealist. Her passions can run hot. They will remain friends through this, but that doesn't mean Leia can't and shouldn't push back. This is a delicate time for the New Republic. When Palpatine founded the Empire, he did so like a parasite, a creature growing inside the body of a stronger host until it could burst free from the skin and take control. The Empire emerged from this brutal chrysalis fully formed, and all it had to do was claim the resources that the winnowing Republic already possessed. Ships, weapons, soldiers, supplies. The New Republic has no such advantage. It must claw and scrape for every ship, every weapon, every scrap of food, and every willing soldier. Mon wants this transition to be as peaceable as possible. That is, of course, a noble goal. And in late nights, the Chancellor confided in Leia that she is wisely struck by the fear of what happened the first time the parasite of Palpatine squirmed under the skin. How easy it was for him to prey on the anxieties of the galaxy. How simple it was for him to turn system against system by stoking the fires of xenophobia, anger, selfishness. And here, Luke's voice echoes in her mind. The ways and tools of the dark side, Leia. How do you form an empire? By stealing a republic. And how do you steal a republic? By convincing its people that they cannot govern themselves. That freedom is their enemy, and that fear is their ally. Palpatine was an able puppet master. He gave himself the power. He pulled on all the strings, and the galaxy danced to his whims. Mon, thankfully, wants no such power, and so she's already begun seeding it. As Chancellor, she's put up votes that have begun the path of demilitarization. That presents a sign of moral strength, but also sends up a signal of defensive vulnerability. That means getting her to approve new military contracts, like the creation of the Starhawks, is like pulling the teeth from the mouth of an ornery tauntaun. As to defeating the scattered remains of the Empire, Mon seems of a mind to let that infection burn itself out. Strike when necessary, and otherwise sit back and let the antibodies of a free galaxy do the work. That, Leia believes, misunderstands the infection. It won't take much for the disease to again take hold. And sometimes diseases evolve. Worse, what does it say to those systems that need the New Republic right now? The Empire still enslaves whole worlds. Like Kashyyyk, she thinks. Kashyyyk, one planet where the New Republic is content to let the Empire burn itself out. That comes with an undercurrent of grim, overly pragmatic reality. The Wookiees are not a meaningful resource to the New Republic. Not militarily, not governmentally. Kashyyyk has resources, but none so dramatic that the New Republic is willing to sacrifice ships. And besides, the Empire has plundered most of those resources already. But sacrifice is everything, isn't it? It means the willingness to leap into the void to save those who need saving. To save your friends. We argue, Leia says suddenly, about whether it is the time to build up the military or to dampen its effect. And all the while we forget that we have the privilege of arguing from comfortable chairs many parsecs away. We argue about what's prudent or what's practical while people suffer. Do you know what people want to see from the New Republic? Do you truly? Mon seeds the floor. Please. They want us to be heroes. A moment passes where everyone chuckles uncomfortably, at least until they realize she's quite serious. Mon says,
I know. You're not wrong, and you are a hero, and you helped us all be the heroes needed to get to this point. But such passion and idealism have to be tempered by reality. This is a government. It has a lot of moving pieces.
Leia stiffens.
And that is where we'll fail. This isn't a machine, Chancellor. When did we start to see this as a government and not a collection of people helping people? We've started seeing territories and battle logistics and votes. We've stopped seeing hearts and minds and faces. The more we do that, the more we lose. Of ourselves, of the galaxy. Running a galactic government is complex. Then I don't want to run a galactic government!
Her words come out louder than she means them to. All in the room seem startled by their intensity.
Empty yourself. Center yourself.
She must, but she can't. Mon says softly.
This is about Kashyyyk. About Han. We should have helped the Wookiees.
Her voice trembles with rage and sorrow.
I understand.
Mon speaks like a mother to a tantruming child. Slow, steady, and with a condescending tone.
She's talking down to me. My own friend is talking to me like I'm a youngling. But as we discussed, we ran the numbers, we performed the simulations, and now is not the sensible time.
Sensible? Leia barks. We've lost all sense, I fear.
You're right. I shouldn't have come to this meeting.
Akbar calls after her, but she doesn't stop. Leia turns heel and marches back out of the meeting room. If only she could slam the door, but it wishes gently shut behind her. A transmission shimmers into being. There, projected above Rax's desk, is the visage of a Bith, a drink slinger from the distant planet of Iridiru. His appearance can only mean good news. The Bith's massive cranium turns left and right, as if to make sure he's alone. Satisfied, the bartender says,
They're here. And they're together.
A smile spreads across Rax's face like a consuming fire. It warms him, this news. It's taken too long to get here. So many puzzle pieces to nudge into place. And my, how those pieces were stubborn. Setting up a convincing mystery and threat is delicate work. One must commit to the theatrics, but never overdo them. If any detected his shadowy hands above all of it, directing the stage, they would buck like an ill-saddled beast. The contingency continues, he thinks. Good, Gallius Rax says.
Continue monitoring. Credits will be forthcoming.
Then he ends the transmission. He wonders if Golos Aram is a piece deserving of a nudge or two.
Patience,
he chides himself. Let the mechanism work. Part of that mechanism is Sloane. She is one who has detected his shadow behind it all. That is a problem. Maybe one he can use to his advantage yet. It is time to call her in. Time, too, for one last test. The room is white and mostly empty. The walls are padded. The windows are many, and the sunlight streaming in is bold and bright. The only things in this room are Leia and a potted plant. The plant is a sapling of the sanctuary trees of Endor, though some call it a serpent's puzzle, named so after the way the dark branches weave together in a kind of organic knotwork. She grew it from a seed, a small, knobby acorn given to her by the little Ewok known as Wicket. She grew the plant in a pot of Chandrillan soil, and to her shock and delight, it took. It has become a focus of her meditations, as suggested by Luke. She decided, after storming out of the meeting room, that it was best to come here. Best for her to focus on something that wasn't the state of the galaxy or the nascent New Republic, or that nagging feeling in the deep of her middle that Mon has betrayed her in some small but significant way. She sits with it in the middle of the room. She clears her mind, and then she tries to feel the tree. She does this at least once a day. Leia has never felt the tree. Not for lack of trying. She sits here. She empties herself of breath, and then she tries to free herself of thought, just like Luke taught her to. That part works fine most of the time. But he said it was possible to feel the life force of things with the Force. She swore to him that she just doesn't have it. It being that mystical, intangible power that her brother possesses, and, this thought comes with a set of chills grappling up her spine, that her father, her birth father, possessed too. Luke continues to swear that with time, she will come to feel the Force just as he does. He explained that it was how she felt his pain back during Cloud City. Him hanging there, wearied and beaten, and about to fall into the roiling clouds below. He said he'd teach her. And he did teach her. Some things, at least. Then, he left. Just like Han left.
Luke.
She finds her mind wandering to him now. Her thoughts reach for her wayward brother like a living thing, like branches seeking the sun.
I need you here. I need your help.
Luke sometimes had a farm boy's naivete, yes. But right now, she feels she could use a little of that. Her mind is a tangle of thoughts. The complexities of politics, the love of and anger over Han, the loss of Luke, and above all else, the ever-persistent worry about the life she carries. Her skin tingles. Her mind feels suddenly unmoored from the rest of her. Leia feels dizzy enough to fall over.
Oh. Oh my!
There.
There it is. Washing over her and through her. An awareness unlike any she's ever felt before. A pulsing glow, flickering and strong.
It's not the plant. It's not Luke. It's not even Han.
It's her child.
This isn't just a mother's recognition of the life inside. That she already knows. She's already well aware of the bump and tumble of that little person she carries. And she already knows about the heartburn, and the pre-breakfast nausea, and the post-breakfast nausea, and the post-post-breakfast hunger.
Oh, and this goes beyond all that. This is something separate from her. It isn't a physical feeling. It is all around her. It suffuses her like the perfume from a jungle of flowers. As such, she is suddenly aware of her child's mind and spirit. She senses pluck and wit and steel blood and a keen mind. Oh, and by the blood of Alderaan, is this one going to be a fighter? Wait, he? It's a boy. It's a boy. Her hands fly in front of her mouth as she both laughs and cries at the same time. This, she thinks, is the light side that Luke always goes on about. The promise of light. The promise of a new life. And then, the black edging of the dark side encircles her bliss like a noose. Because what rides swift on the heels of hope but fear? A fear that stretches out far and wide like a growing shadow. Fear of having a child in an unstable galaxy. Fear of whether or not Han is alive, or Luke too. Will the child grow up with a father? An uncle? A mentor? What is her legacy? And what will her boy's legacy be? Her breath catches in her chest. She has to force herself to breathe.
Clear your mind. Clear it all. Focus, Leia. Focus.
Are those her thoughts? Or are they Luke's? The Empire cares little for the fripperies of life, preferring instead to put a cold, gray veneer on just about everything. But Gallius Rax grew up in a dead place, and so putting in this garden here on the upper echelons of the Ravager gives him a source of solace. From behind him, Ray Sloan clears her throat. He does not turn. He suspects she has brought a blaster. Sloan does not trust him, but he suspects she feels trapped by her options. The one option that makes the most sense, the one that would demonstrate strength that few others would deny, would be to burn a hole in his back. Fleet Admiral Rax hopes now to change that. "You despise me," he says, staring at the stalk of a red-tongued kubari flower. Its petals have many layers, each folded against the next. The prettiest, most crimson petals, in fact, remain hidden from view.
"No,"
she says. A lie, certainly.
"Of course not. I respect you."
"You can respect me and despise me at the same time. I felt much the same way about our former emperor. He was mighty and deserving of praise. He was also a monster, and one who made mistakes.
That would have been heresy if Palpatine were still alive. Still might be, if those words were uttered to the wrong person."
"Be that as it may,"
she says, suddenly uncomfortable,
"if you worry about me, please don't."
"And yet I do. I know you've been to see Mos Amida. I know you've been investigating me in a way that goes well beyond cursory checkups. And I would guess that right now, feeling cornered, you are reaching for that elegant chrome blaster you keep at your hip. But I ask you to wait."
In the reflection of the blast glass enclosure, he sees her hand hovering near the weapon. So close. To her credit, she denies nothing.
Good. He likes her.
He would hate to have that feeling diminished by something so weak as a common lie.
Lies must be big, grand, full of purpose. "Go on,"
she says.
Now he turns.
His arms spread wide and welcoming. His mouth pulled tight in a cold, rictus grin.
"I want to tell you my plan."
Confusion flickers on her face like a short-circuiting holovid.
"Why? Why now? You've kept me at arm's length."
"Yes, because I am distrustful by nature. And because the future of this empire traipses delicately upon a wire. The chasm beneath it is deep, and I don't wish to shoulder it into the abyss by trusting the wrong people."
Sloane narrows her eyes.
"You're pulling strings, Admiral. I don't know what they're connected to or why you're pulling them. I don't even know who you are or where you come from. You are little more than a shadow, and yet you lead the Empire.
Secretly. You're the Grand Admiral here, I'll remind you."
"Entitled, yes. And your leadership is not that secret. You're out in the open more than you think. Word will get out."
"And when it does, I will confirm that I remain your most trusted advisor. A war hero who supports your own candidacy for Emperor."
"Who are you, Admiral?"
Rax rolls his eyes. Such a brutal, worthless question. He doesn't care to waste time on it. As if the identity of one man is really all that special.
"The beauty is in the total mechanism, not the parts pulled out of it."
Instead, he cuts to the quick.
"I plan on attacking Chandrila," he says.
The shock on her face. He won't lie and say it doesn't please him. It means she didn't see that coming. If she didn't, nobody will.
"For so long we've remained still, patient, waiting,"
she says.
"And now it's time to return to the galaxy and strike at the heart of the New Republic. Our attack will stagger them."
"The fleet's hiding in the nebulae. Will you utilize them?"
He offers another vicious smile, and she mistakes it as confirmation.
"When?
she asks.
Soon. All the pieces are almost in place.
What pieces?
In time. You'll see.
Sloane bristles at that.
I need to know.
And I need you to trust. All will become clear in time. I want you with me through all of it, Grand Admiral Sloane. You are a vital resource.
He says that last sentence as something he hopes is true. He will have to test her this one last time, just as he was tested many times.
Do you trust me?
She hesitates.
I don't know.
An honest answer. Good. Tell no one of this little talk. I'll let you know when it's time. Be ready.
And with that, he walks past her, because the conversation is over.
Interlude. Tatooine.
It is a difficult thing being a creature without purpose.
The purpose of the man, Malakili, was once to give purpose to such creatures. He was always good with beasts. As a child in a Nar Shaddaa slum, he taught vicious gug worms to stop stealing from the food stores, and over time they became his pets, his friends, his protectors. Later he would help tame and prepare a variety of beasts for the hut circuses. Sand dragons and killwings and little womp rats in their little outfits. And then later, his precious joy, the rancors. Those, the monsters none could tame but he.
And now, his last rancor, Patissa, is dead. Crushed by a lucky fool in black.
Worse, his employer is also gone. Eradicated by that same lucky fool and his cruel friends. Malakili and the others were left in the palace after Jabba's sail barge erupted in belching fire. All of them unsure as to what exactly to do now. A new hut would come to occupy the dais, they said. And so many stayed as the food dwindled and the water ran out. Soon those left began drifting away too. Off into the sands and away across the dunes. No hut was coming. The galaxy was changing. Could it be that the huts were fighting? Some underworld war pitting slug against slug? Malakili was one of the last in the palace. And then one day, he left too. He thought maybe to tame the glorious monstrosity at the bottom of the great pit of Carcoon, and failing that, to throw himself into its maw. But the mighty Sarlacc was injured. Burning wreckage from the sail barge had rained upon it. Already its body, considerably more massive than the mouth exposed from the sliding sands, had been partially unburied, its stomach tube slit open, its digesting innards pillaged by industrious Jawas. They pulled out weapons and armor, droids and tools, and skeletons, of course. The creature of Carcoon had a pure purpose, to wait and to eat. And now it was left to thrash and wail in the grip of pillagers. Malakili wept at another life without purpose.
He wandered, as many do. He felt like a scrap of cloth or a wad of trash blown across the desert, pushed this way and pulled that way, rolling without destination, without meaning. And now he thinks,
I am going to die.
The Red Key thugs found him wandering toward Mos Pelgo. They gave chase, but he is older and slower than he used to be. One hit him from behind, and now his face is pressed into the hot sand. A boot pushes on his neck, and the bones in his back grind. One of the Red Key raiders, men who claim to work for the new mining conglomerate, a conglomerate even naive Malakili knows to be just a front for a criminal syndicate, rips off his leather hood and presses a blaster into the back of his skull. They rip his satchel from his shoulder and empty it onto the sand. His water skin finds its way into one of the thug's hands, who parts the leather from in front of his face and drinks what little is left. The rest of Malakili's belongings decorate the dirt. A lucky braid of bantha fur and teeth, a small water shiv made of dewback bone, a few droid gears and shiny chits to give to the Jawas or to pay off the grunting Tuskens. A man who introduces himself as Bivum Gorge rasps in Malakili's ear.
What else you got, Wanderer? These sands are Red Key sands, and Lorgan Morvelin is taking his cut. Wouldn't want his cut to be your ears or your tongue, would you?
The second thug chuckles through a respirator. As if to demonstrate, the first thug stabs a gleaming hunting knife down into the ground. It hits the sand with a hiss. Above them, the shriek of a blaster bolt. And then, the thug hits the sand too. He topples like a vaporator knocked flat by a stomping bantha. His head turns toward Malakili as smoke rises from a patch of burned hair and skin on the far side of his skull. The thug's mouth works soundlessly. Then his eyes go dim. Suddenly the air erupts with blaster fire. The second thug gargles rage through his respirator, but even this is short-lived. He staggers backward, arms flailing, the rifle dropping out of his hand. That thug joins his friend. The Suns will claim him. Malakili does not move. Whoever is coming is worse than these two, and so it seems better to play dead. That, a trick he learned from many of the beasts he trained. Prey knows that the best costume from a predator is the already dead.
Please let me be. Please let me be. Please.
But why? To what purpose? To be saved? To be spared? Is a privilege that should belong to one with purpose. Footsteps approach, boots thumping on the sand.
You can get up.
A voice, male, gruff, plain, clear. Another voice, a woman's voice.
Relax. We're not raiders.
We're law.
Law? On Tatooine? No such thing. The Hutts were the law. Jabba was law. But now, with Jabba dead... Malakili rolls over and sits up. There, a man in Mandalorian armor. The suit of it pocked and pitted and streaked with scars. Armor that looks eerily familiar, and Malakili's innards clench at the sight of it. A carbine hangs at the man's side. Next to him stands a tall woman. Headtails, which means she's Twi'lek, though one of those headtails is mangled, its ends puckered with scar tissue. At her hips hang twin pistols. "I'm Issa Orr," she says, a sneer to her lips. The man removes his helmet. His cheeks are lined with salt and pepper stubble. He winces against the double Suns.
"I'm Cobb Vance, lawman and de facto mayor of what used to be Mos Pelgo."
"Freetown now," the Twi'lek says. "A place where good people can come if they're willing to work. If they're willing to stand tall against the syndicates. Against folks like Lorgan and Redkey."
Malakili nods as if he understands, but he does not. Not yet. Cobb kneels down.
"You look familiar to me."
"I am no one."
"Everybody's someone, my friend. Thing about Freetown is... to live inside our walls means to be useful. Are you useful?"
And here, Malakili's spirits sink. He is not useful to anyone. He admits as such, his dry eyes going suddenly wet with tears.
"I have no value to you. Kill me. My creature Patisse is dead. All my beasts are gone."
The Twi'lek says,
"You a beastmaster?"
"Master. If only he deserved such a word." But he gives an uncertain nod.
"I train beasts, yes."
The two share a look. Vanth chuckles, a dry sound like rocks rolling together down the side of a cliff.
We got a couple of unruly Rontos that could use a steady hand. Can you handle that? There'd be payment and a homestead for you if you care to claim it.
His sinking spirits are suddenly buoyant. Purpose dawns inside his heart, bringing light to darkness once more.
I can.
There's something else,
Issa Orr says.
Should we tell him?
Why not? If anybody can help.
Cobb leans in close, and as he helps Malakili up, the man says in a low voice, as if the sand might be listening,
You know much about huts?
I know quite a bit.
You think you could train one?
Aye. They are sentient beings, not pets.
Fine. Teach one, then?
I could, I believe. But why?
Issa Orr grins.
Because we have one. At Freetown.
A baby,
Cobb says, scratching his jaw.
Seems that Red Key was trying to sneak one in. Install it onto the palace dais. We interrupted that little plan, and now we got this slug. I'm not sure what to do with it. If you can help us with the Rontos, maybe the hut, you got a place of Freetown. How's that sound, friend?
It sounds
like purpose.
Most excellent. Thank you.
You can thank me by doing your job.
Let's go, Issa Orr says. Leave the corpses for the others to find. Let them see that law, true law, is spreading across the land.
Chapter 19. Sinjir assured Nora that a glass of the Kurva would do it, and he was right. As soon as she eases the glass under Solo's nose, the vapor hits him. The smuggler's eyes bolt open, and he stares back with a turbo-laser intensity.
What the...
he says, suddenly scrambling to stand.
Leia?
No,
Nora says. She's alone with him in the main hold of the Halo.
It's Nora Wexley. We're on Iridiru, remember?
He winces. His hand moves to rub the lump forming under his hairline.
Attacked by a droid?
He scrunches up his face in disbelief.
An old Clone Wars battle droid, of all things. I must be hallucin-
Movement from behind her. Mr. Bones leans around the corner, poking his vulture's skull droid head out. Han paws at his side for one of his blasters, but Nora holds his wrist and moves to block the view of the droid.
Go away!
She spits at Bones.
Go! Shoo, you bag of bones!
Roger, roger, Temmins, Mom!
The droid recedes. Han growls.
That droid is yours?
My son's.
Damn thing knocked me out cold! You bring that rickety clanker back here. I want to shoot its arms off. Then I want to beat it with its own arms. Then I want to take its head.
Nora eases him back into the chair. I apologize for the droid. We looked at your head. The injury is superficial.
Great. Thanks, Doc. Now do as I said. Get out of here and let me get back to work. You're slowing me down.
We want to help.
I don't need your help, lady.
You're alone out here. I think you do.
He scowls at her and sits forward.
Why? Why help me? I don't know you. I didn't do anything for you. And I'm tired of owing people.
We owe you.
Not according to my tally,
he says, tapping his temple.
I keep the ledgers up here. And your name's not in it, honey.
We could have just shipped you back to Chandrilla, you know. Tied you to a chair. But you're a hero of the galaxy. You and your friends, you saved us all. This is how we pay you back.
She stiffens.
Also, please don't call me honey.
He stands up.
I can do this by myself.
No, you can't.
But she placates him anyway. I'm sure you could.
I work alone.
Obviously. His eyes pinch, and his hand idly scratches at the beard growth along his jaw.
But I do need Chewie back.
Nora understands. He's trying to ask for help, but he's too calloused, too gruff and tumble to really ask. She offers it again.
So let us help. We can offer extra hands, extra guns. We'll follow your lead.
That might make it easier.
He sizes her up with his eyes.
Might. But like you said, you need to follow my lead.
Done.
Fine. You can help me get a ram.
Nora stands up, too, offering her hand.
We'll help you get Chewie back, too.
Well, then. In for a credit, in for a crate.
He takes her hand.
Welcome to Team Solo. Hope you can keep up, Nora.
Chapter 20. Everything's going according to plan. That thrills Jazz in no small way. The plan is everything. Designing one is like making a clock. All these little parts working together, turning, tugging, ticking. And at the end of the day, it either tells time or it doesn't. And this plan, it's going along like clockwork. She got to take out the pulse mines first. Jazz took up the same place on the plateau overlooking Golas Aram's compound, and she used the scope on her slug thrower to identify the electronic signatures from each of